It is 5:21 in the morning on May 20, 1927. Roosevelt Field, Long Island. The air is heavy with damp, the runway has standing water in the wheel ruts from rain the night before. A crowd of well-wishers and reporters has been there since before dawn, and they are watching a silver monoplane loaded so far past its normal limits that the tires are pressed nearly flat into the mud. The engine is already running, a single right whirlwind, 9 cylinders, 220 horsepower. At the controls is a 25-year-old airmail pilot from Minnesota who has not slept in more than 24 hours. He has studied this moment for months. He has talked to engineers, pestered weather forecasters, and crossed the country twice just to get himself to this particular runway. And now the moment has arrived. He is as alone as a pilot has ever been. No navigator, no radio, no co-pilot, a thermos of coffee and 5 sandwiches he will barely touch. A magnetic compass and his own mind. I'm Taildragger, and you're listening to The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Tonight we're going to fly to Paris. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, let me take you back a few years before that muddy runway, because to understand what Charles Lindbergh was walking into, you have to understand the world he was walking into. In 1919, a French-born hotelier named Raymond Ortega announced a prize. $25,000, which in today's money would be somewhere north of $400,000, to the first aviator to fly nonstop between New York and Paris, either direction. The announcement sat there for 6 years without a serious claimant, because nobody had an airplane that could make the crossing. The Atlantic is 3,600 miles of unforgiving ocean. Even with the best technology of the early 20s, the attempt was less a competition than a death sentence dressed up as an adventure. By 1926, things had changed. Engines had become genuinely reliable. Aircraft designers were getting serious about range, and suddenly the prize attracted real contenders. Commander Richard Byrd, who had already flown over the North Pole, was organizing a trimotor Fokker with a serious, well-funded crew. Clarence Chamberlain was working toward a record-setting endurance flight in his Belanca monoplane. The French war heroes Charles Nungesser and François Colly attempted the crossing from Paris in early May of 1927 and vanished somewhere over the Atlantic. Their fate was never determined, the wreckage was never found. The prize was becoming dangerous, men were dying for it, and into this atmosphere walked Charles Lindbergh. Lindbergh was not a household name. He flew the Chicago to St. Louis airmail route for Robertson Aircraft. He was known in the small world of barnstormers and contract pilots as a cool head and a careful planner, a man who had bailed out of a stricken mailplane not once but twice and walked away from both. He did not have Byrd's pedigree or Chamberlain's public profile. What he had was a theory, and the theory was different from everyone else's. Everyone in the competition was thinking bigger, multiple engines for redundancy, navigators and radio operators for safety. Large, heavily equipped aircraft loaded with crew and gear, Lindbergh thought the opposite. He wanted one engine, because every additional engine was just another thing that could quit at the wrong moment. He wanted one pilot, because a navigator and radio operator were dead weight if you were willing to do the work of dead reckoning and trust your instruments. He wanted to strip every unnecessary ounce off the airframe, because fuel was range, and range was the whole problem. He shopped his concept to established manufacturers. Wright Aeronautical turned him down. Travel Air was interested, but wanted too much time. Then someone suggested a small shop in San Diego, Ryan Airlines. A converted fish cannery on the harbor waterfront, a couple dozen workers, and a willingness to try something bold. Ryan had been building a standard monoplane for airmail contracts, a dependable if ordinary machine. The proposal was to take that basic design, stretch the fuselage, enlarge the wing, fit it with a much larger fuel tank, and build the whole thing around a Wright Whirlwind J5C engine. Ryan's chief engineer, Donald Hall, did the calculations on the fuel load and the range and believed it could work. He and Lindbergh met for the first time and talked for hours. Lindbergh moved into a boarding house 2 blocks from the factory. He was there every day. He measured the cockpit himself, making sure it fit his 6-foot-2-inch frame. He specified that the wicker pilot seat should be as light as possible. He eliminated the heavy earth inductor compass another manufacturer had sold him and replaced it with a simpler magnetic compass. He removed the fuel gauges from inside the cockpit and replaced them with a simpler float gauge visible through a window in the wing. Every decision was a weight decision. Every ounce removed was another gallon of fuel he could carry. The main fuel tank sat directly in front of the pilot's position, between the instrument panel and the engine. This meant Lindbergh would have no forward view through a windshield, none. Instead, a periscope was mounted on the left side of the fuselage, and there were small windows on either side. To see what was ahead of him, he would have to use the periscope or bank gently left or right and look out the side. To land, he would have to put his head out the window and look forward from a sideways angle, like a man leaning out of a moving car. He accepted all of this. Ryan Airlines built the Spirit of St. Louis in 58 days. Total cost, $10,580, funded by a group of St. Louis businessmen who believed in the project. The aircraft weighed roughly 2,100 pounds empty, loaded for the transatlantic flight with 450 gallons of fuel. It would tip the scales at just over 5,200 pounds, more than twice its empty weight. A machine being asked to lift and carry and sustain itself on a fuel load, it was designed around and barely ready to carry. By mid-May, the competition was nearing its peak. Byrd was ready. Chamberlain was ready. They were all waiting on weather, watching the North Atlantic forecast, looking for a window in the relentless spring storms. Then on May 19th, the picture began to shift. A high-pressure system was building over the ocean. Not a perfect forecast, but a workable one. Dr. James Kimball, the New York weather forecaster the pilots were relying on, thought conditions would be passable. Chamberlain's backers got into a legal dispute that grounded him at the worst possible moment. Byrd looked at the same forecast and decided to wait. Lindbergh looked at the same forecast and said it was good enough. He drove to the field that evening. The Spirit was pulled from the hangar and fueled. Every gallon was measured carefully. The tires sank visibly under the load. There were small mechanical delays. Reporters crowded around him asking questions he didn't feel like answering. He tried to sleep in a nearby building around midnight and lay there awake for 2 hours before giving up. At 5:21 in the morning, he rolled the throttle open. Now here's where it gets interesting. The runway at Roosevelt Field was soft from the rain. The Spirit was at maximum weight. There was a slight tailwind working against him. And at the far end of the runway stood telephone wires stretched across the departure path. The Spirit of St. Louis rolled down that runway for 5 seconds. 10 seconds. The tail came up slowly. 15 seconds, 20 seconds. The crowd watched. At 23 seconds, the wheels broke free of the mud. He cleared those telephone wires by about 20 feet. What followed was 33 hours, 30 minutes, and 30 seconds of flying, alone. In the first hours, he flew up the coast of New England, then over Nova Scotia, and then out over the Atlantic. The morning turned gray and featureless. The ocean offered nothing to look at, no towns, no roads, no rivers to follow, just water in every direction and a compass needle and a man holding a heading in his exhausted mind while the world flattened into gray sameness. He flew through fog banks that forced him down to within 10 feet of the wave tops, close enough to feel the spray of the swells. He flew through light icing that rimmed the leading edges of the wings and forced him to climb above the cloud deck and navigate by stars. He flew through clear patches of Atlantic night where the stars were so dense and bright they seemed like a second ocean above him. Sleep was the real enemy. Lindbergh had not slept in more than 24 hours before he even left the ground. By the middle of the crossing, somewhere over the cold darkness of the North Atlantic, he was fighting hallucinations. He wrote later, in his memoir called The Spirit of St. Louis, that ghostly figures seemed to fill the cockpit alongside him, vaporous and indistinct, talking to him, offering advice, appearing and disappearing without warning. He recognized them as symptoms of extreme sleep deprivation and fought them with everything he had. He slapped his face. He held his hand out into the freezing slipstream. He opened the side window and let the cold air blast him. He kept talking to himself, out loud, to stay present. He ate one of his sandwiches. Just one. He was not hungry. 27 hours into the flight, he spotted a fishing boat below him through a gap in the clouds. He circled it and leaned out of the cockpit and shouted down, asking if he was on course. The fishermen stared up at him from the rolling deck and said nothing. Maybe they couldn't hear him over the whirlwind. Maybe they were simply too astonished to respond. He rocked his wings and flew on. Then through the overcast, he saw land, Ireland, the southwest coast, County Clare. And he was within 3 miles of his planned course after 27 hours over open ocean, navigating entirely by dead reckoning. 3 miles. Pull up a chair and let that settle for a moment. No satellite navigation, no inertial platform, no moving map, a magnetic compass, a watch, an airspeed indicator, and a human brain that had not slept in 2 days. 3 miles off course after crossing an ocean. He flew over England and across the Channel as the sun went down. The lights of France came up below him. He had been told to look for the Seine and follow it northeast toward Le Bourget Aerodrome. He found the river. He found the field. But something else was happening below that he could not quite understand at first. The roads around the aerodrome were not dark, they were lit up for miles in every direction, an enormous glowing mass of automobiles and people, 100,000 Parisians who had been listening to radio updates about his progress for 2 days and driven out of the city to be there when he landed. Lindbergh touched down at 10:22 Paris time on May 21, 1927. The crowd overwhelmed the fence before he had finished his landing roll. They surged the aircraft and pulled him from the cockpit and hoisted him on their shoulders, and for a moment he was afraid the crowd might damage the spirit of St. Louis. And then the crowd was so dense and so unstoppable that he stopped worrying about the aircraft because there was absolutely nothing he could do. He had flown 3,600 miles on dead reckoning and instinct and caffeine, and he had landed in the middle of history. What happened next belongs partly to aviation and partly to something larger. 4 million people turned out for a ticker tape parade in New York that has never been matched. He received the Medal of Honor and the Distinguished Flying Cross and the Ortaig Prize, though he had spent more than the prize money just getting to the starting line. Passenger traffic on American Airlines surged in the months after his flight. Private investment poured into aircraft manufacturers. The public, which had watched aviation as a spectacle for novelty seekers, began to understand it as a system for actually moving people across the world. Lindbergh himself lived a complicated life. He was a brilliant engineer and a passionate conservationist and a deeply controversial figure in the years before World War II. History holds him in complicated hands, and rightly so, but on the morning of May 20, 1927, he was something simpler and more extraordinary. He was a pilot who believed the crossing was possible when the odds said it probably was not, and he flew until it was done. The spirit of St. Louis hangs today in the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum in Washington. You can stand under it and look up at the main fuel tank that blocked his forward view, at the small side windows, at the periscope mounted on the fuselage, and think about what it meant to point that nose east with 5 sandwiches and a compass and 3,600 miles of cold Atlantic between you and a lit runway in France. That is the whole story. 33 hours and 30 minutes. Sources tonight include Lindbergh's own memoir, A. Scott Berg's biography, and the Smithsonian's records on the spirit of St. Louis. More at RadioHanger.com. I'm Taildragger. Good night.